Welcome. I love the fact that it's hard for me to get control again. Never had it. Exactly right, Bondsworth. You're always reminding me, Bill. Good. Just a few things I want to cover in the bulletin. And I know Janelle here. Is Janelle, are you here? Raise your hand just for a second. You're hiding in the back, and I'm pointing you out. Janelle, we've been praying for you and in regards to your father for a long time, and Janelle's dad has been missing. Janelle's father, Walt Dorn, had been missing for quite a bit of time now, and he disappeared down visiting a friend. Most of you know that in the community, and maybe some of you don't know that Walt's remains were found, and Walt has passed away. And I'll be doing the funeral for Walt on the 30th. And it was a really long, difficult time for the family. Obviously, it brings closure, but it also opens up now the mourning process, and it dashes still, you know, the slim hope that many people had that he would be okay and be found somewhere. So I just want you to know, Janelle, we love you. We surround you. I'm proud of you and of your family and of the way you conducted and this thing. And we're with you in this grieving process. And I'll be privileged to do your father's funeral. He was a neighbor of mine. He lived just a few houses down, and it was hard not to go by that house every day over the past months, you know, just praying and wondering what turned out. So just lift up Janelle and the whole Dorn family, and I know you are more than welcome to join. You'll get the information about the upcoming funeral as well. On a more pleasant note, just want you to know, we're doing some really neat things with the children's ministries. Every week we're going to have a leader and wife. So in the case, either a pastor or either an elder and his wife and or another leader and his wife, kind of just supporting the ministry of Promised Land and shepherding and just being with the kids, just cruising through from the nursery to the toddler's room to the threes and fours and fives and just shepherding. And then having a teaching time as well with the kids. And I'm really excited about that. For example, it allows me to do something that I've always desired in the past, to have some coordination between what I'm doing here in church as well as what's taking place over there. So for your information, you know, a segment of the closing teaching that I'm doing here in regards to anger, the kids are also going to be discussing anger over there and how to deal with anger. And it's really exciting for me to have that kind of coordination for the first time of bringing our stories together so that I think you can better relate to your kids and your kids to you on some of the subject matter that's being taught here. I don't know what to do with Wednesday, so I'm going to take a straw poll, which is going to get me, I'm sure, a clearly defined 50-50, you know, which means... But we have a really, you know, third Wednesdays are our Wednesday nights, family nights here, and it's a great event. We have a ton of fun. Next week, maybe more so than other weeks, we were really expecting to be able to use outdoors. We were going to have fire pits and do s'mores and guitars and campfire singing and stuff like that as a part of our Winter Blast Family Wednesday. So I was inclined, because I don't know if you've heard, it's supposed to rain next week, and not just drizzle, but it's supposed to be like a big mother of all storms, kind of storms rolling through. I don't know if that's true or not. I just know that it's supposed to, and I thought, well, we have the Wednesday night program that could really put a damper on things, I guess that's where it comes from. So I don't know whether to do it or not, because the flip side is that perhaps some of you by Wednesday are ready, you know, because you've been locked up with the kids and they're bouncing off the wall and you want to get them out somewhere where they can run around here and release energy. And I'm game for that, because we can move things inside, or we can just move it inside and just do dodgeball or something and just have a great time with the kids. So I'm seeing some thumbs up. How many think, show of hands, we should do something Wednesday night? So let me see. How many think we should do something Wednesday night as opposed to wait till the next Wednesday when it's dry? Can I see a show of hands? Okay. How many think we should wait till the next Wednesday? Solidly 50-50. How many of you don't care either way? Woo! There we go. So, based upon that, I have no idea. So we're going to do it. No. Well, you know what? I'm going to go with a gut instinct. We're going to show up and do it Wednesday. And then we'll see what happens. And if we don't like it, then we'll do it the Wednesday after that, too. And then after that, and then after that. Okay, so command decision, right? You're a fireman, Rob. You know, sometimes you just got to make decisions, right? Except when they're the wrong ones, then you run into trouble. Okay, check out your bulletins. I feel like I'm forgetting something. There's a whole bunch of thank yous in there. We just want to get into the habit of thanking people. I don't think we do that well enough. Tim Reed helped fix our roof. Eric Hodd just recently fixed the van. Joe Garcia's landscaping. Bruce and Linda Noffrey, lower landscaping. George Garvey, as I said, who likes to blow leaves and not hot air. There you are, George. You've blown those leaves on Saturday. There are many more to come, but check your bulletins out. We're changing the bulletins a little bit. Primarily, you've got me to blame on that. So, sense of humor required. Okay. Just letting you know right now. Sense of humor required. All right. I was with a few pastors the other day and at a little mini conference thing done. One was from Birmingham, Alabama, and the other one was from Des Moines, Iowa. And a couple of them I was conversing with, and they got to talking about the subject of the role of women in the church and how they need to be so submissive. And the guy from Birmingham, Alabama, just, you know, he pulled out the scriptures, you know, a wife is supposed to be submissive. And he goes, you know, when I got married, I showed these verses to my wife and pointed it out to her, my expectations. And he said, the first day, I didn't see much difference. But by the second day, I could see that she was getting on board. She was cleaning the dishes. She was prepping a hot meal every day I got home. She was making sure things were tidy. She was obeying me nicely. And then the Midwestern preacher came in from Des Moines, and he said, well, you know, I did the same thing with my wife, and I read those scriptures to her, and then, you know, first day I didn't, you know, see much change, and the second day I didn't see much change, but by the third day I began to see the change. She also got online, started, you know, doing the laundry and submitting to me. And I said, you know, I read those verses to my wife. She's a California girl. And I said, you know, first day I didn't see much, and the second day I didn't see much, third day I didn't see much. I said, by the fourth day, the swelling went down, and I was able to see a little bit again. So, I said, so. Hear it for California girls. All right. All right, now I've endeared myself to the ladies in here. That's a good thing. Check that off. I have a dear friend, and I probably shouldn't do this because he probably won't come back again. But he's been an amazing friend to me and encouragement to me and example to me. And his name is Ched Myers, and he lives here locally. And Ched is an astute and deep Bible teacher and scholar. And theologian, and some of his work has certainly had a big impact upon me. And some of you know Ched because I've shared about him before. And Ched, I actually got to know him because I was deeply blessed by his commentary that he wrote on the book of Mark. And as I was teaching the Gospel of Mark and going through sources, Ryan turned me on to this great commentary on the Gospel of Mark. And I was like, wow, this is great. It's just really some profound and deep teaching that I gleaned out of that and insight. And as I did that, it wasn't until we got to the very back cover that we realized, hey, he lives locally. You know, so knocked on his door, and he's become, for me, especially a very good friend. And Ched is here. Ched Myers, I just want you to wave and say hello to everybody. I want to thank you, and I want you to love on this guy because he's a special, special friend to me. And we're able to help his institute, the Bartimaeus Institute, by just having the church facility, and he's able to use that on occasion and bless him back a little bit for all he does for us. So I'm glad to have shed in here. But when you have an astute Bible scholar in the house, it's always a little nerve-wracking when you're up here, okay? Because I can pretty much blow by you with most of the stuff. But if I'm jacking up names or addresses in the Bible, or, you know, I can pretty much, get away with it. Now I'm in trouble. So, anyways, today we're going to enter back into reintroducing the study that we've been engaged in for a while in the book of Genesis. And the book of Genesis is Bereshit in the Hebrew. It means beginnings in the Hebrew. And it's the basis. It is the foundation of our faith in so many ways. It's the first book of the Bible, but it's also a Bible book that begins to really set the cement upon which the whole movement of restoration and reconciliation with God begins. And it explains some things in a beautiful narrative. And we're going to pick that up. Before I do that, I want to kind of review a little bit. If you take the Bible and you break it down into three simple parts, you can break it down into chapters 1 and 2 of the book of Genesis, chapters 21 and 22 of the book of Revelation. And you have two chapters at the beginning and the end. And then you have everything in between. And everything in between basically deals with the issue of sin. Okay? Now, when we talk about sin, we want to have a correct understanding of what that is. Sin is a term that means to miss the mark, to transgress. Sin is really the fracturing of what God's intention is. If you look at chapters 1 and 2 of the Bible, you see God creates everything, and He creates it good. In the Hebrew, tov, T-O-V, tov. It's good. It's beautiful. It's in harmony. God and His creation. God and His, and creation with their God. Man and woman and their environment. Everything is good. And I would submit to you that the word tov is a better... We sometimes think it was perfect. Perfect is a static word. When we think of something as being perfect, we think of it as being finished. Good is loaded with potential. It's just the beginning of something that's going to expand the plan and desire and will of God and His creation. Right? Chapter 3, things break. We're going to look at that in a second. But things break. And the tov, the shalom. And shalom doesn't just mean peace the way we think of it, you know, like the absence of conflict. It means much more than that. It means wholeness, integrity. It's all together the way it's supposed to be. That is broken in chapter 3. And that's the story that continues all the way through the Torah and into what we call the scriptures of the New Testament, all the way to the end and to the last two chapters of a book called Apocalypse or Revelation, where the tov is again established, where the good is established. It starts out with a garden and a tree of life. It ends with a city and trees of life. It's really a beautiful thing, right? So the Bible begins with God creating the heavens and the earth in a beautiful poetic fashion. And it teaches us that God made everything. And He gave us rhythm. So much of the roots of who we are, even as Western civilization stands, finds its rhythm and its roots of justice, its sense of timing and right and wrong, right in this first book. We celebrate a seven-day week. That's the rhythm of our life. That seven-day week is found in the ordered 6 days of creation and then the Shabbat, the seventh day of rest, right? Some way we still connect to that. Even though we're on the wrong day, we're on a Sunday, we're still connecting to the fact of recognizing the rest, the rhythm, the Shabbat, 7 days. That comes from the creation story right in the first chapter, right? And then we see that God creates man and woman. He creates us for relationship with each other and relationship with God. He creates them with responsibilities and privileges to begin to order And when it says rule over, we think of ruling over. We think of really more given responsibility and management for the resources that God has created so that they can expand in the dream of God. And it goes along beautifully until chapter 3. In chapter 3, we see a force that enters the picture, an outside force, a force that is contrary to the desire and will of God. It comes in the form of a serpent. And in this situation, we find rebellion, and powerful symbols come forward. We find rebellion. We find distrust. We find a fracturing of the shalom. The beaker in the laboratory spills over, and a virus escapes, and it begins the corruption of God's perfect and beautiful intention for everything. They eat the apple, the strong, or not an apple, it's really not, it never says an apple. They eat fruit, probably pomegranate, if you want to get technical. But anyways, they rebel against God. This outside force entices rebellion, and they do in distrust. And you see it break down, right? What happens, on that scene? Hiding. Shame. The strong, powerful metaphor of nakedness now being aware of that nakedness before God. God looking for humanity, calling them out. The blame game starts, right? What does Adam say? Well, the woman you put me here with, basically saying, God, it's your fault, and it's her fault. What does he say? Well, the serpent came, his fault. The blame game starts. The fracturing enters. We see other powerful images. We see death enter the picture for the first time. Aware of their nakedness, they attempt to clothe themselves insufficiently. But now God in his grace does the covering. He makes the kapara, the atonement, and covers. But a very interesting happens. We see in the perfect shalom, death enter the picture. There is a consequence. The first animals die. Blood is shed. Clothing is made from skins. And then they are put east of the Garden of Eden. And you can say from that time forward, mankind has been living east of Eden. And the powerful imagery here is anything that's going east in the Bible is generally going in the wrong direction as a kind of a warning light, right? And then after that, what happens? Adam and Eve, in God's grace, they have their progeny. They have children, Cain and Abel. And what happens there? Anger, jealousy, shame, fear, insecurity, and the first murder in the scriptures. And interestingly enough, it's fratricide. A brother killing a brother. And isn't that true? Ironically, in the truest sense of the word, every murder that takes place in the world today from the perspective of God as the creator of all life is a brother killing a brother. It's all family. Blood is shed. And this sin, this brokenness now spreads from the garden to the globe. And as it spreads, we see God at one point, the narrative so beautifully tells us that God has regret. He's sorry he made mankind. He's sorry that the experiment has gone awry. There's issues that come up there that are so deep and so depraved that the rabbinical writers and commentators, the extra-biblical commentary about that, and the midrashes are just radical about what was taking place on the earth. And then apparently God in his own anger says, I gotta stop this. And he looks for somebody to carry on in righteousness. He finds a man named Noah. And Noah becomes the vehicle through which God tries to reboot the earth. The program's gone bad. It's so corrupt. It's got to shut it down and reboot it. And we see genocide at the hands of God. He destroys the earth, save Noah and his family, who are on an ark. And the picture then shows that now humanity repopulates. And maybe, if you're hearing the story for the first time, your hope is up again. Maybe mankind, through this righteous man, Noah, who was a friend of God, is going to get it right. But it doesn't take long. Maybe it's in the story. Maybe it's survivor's guilt. I don't know. But Noah survives the flood. But can you imagine, at least in our own minds, the biblical writers think about it, and certainly the commentators do, what did that look like? Because I love the story of Noah and the ark, and the two by two they came. But the truth is, the land was flooded. The land was flooded, and people were floating, and so were babies and everything else. So Noah plants a vineyard. And the first thing he does is he gets hammered. You know? And right away, you can sense in the story, like, maybe things aren't going to go so good. You know? And then we find one of his sons disrespecting the father, in the father again lying naked and shamed. One of the sons comes in, and we're not exactly sure what, but it's deeper than what we see on the surface, and you can get some of the midrash on that, because in the original language, did something awful to the naked father, and we're like, wow, this is bad, and now. Comes blessings and curses again. Cursed be Canaan. A curse comes out. And we see the breakdown continues again and ends up at a tower called Babel, where we see humanity coming together in opposition to God. And we see a quantum leap in technology. The rock, the stone, becomes a brick. You gotta understand, you can't miss that verse there. The rock becomes a brick. Now technology enters the picture. It's true for us today. What is technology going to be used for, good or bad? Is it going to bring us closer to God's shalom, or is it going to take us in the opposite direction? But here, the brick is used to build a monument, a tower to themselves, up to the heavens. And it's interesting, when you look at the ziggurats that you find in Mesopotamia and modern day what is now Iraq, you see those things. And they build them, interestingly, not with mortar, but with pitch, bitumen, with tar. Why? Because it's waterproof. As if to say, hey, look at God, even you can't flood this thing out. We're building above and beyond that. We're building a tower to ourselves. This is the same as the computer chip, the automobile, the Industrial Revolution. The question begs, where is technology going to take us? In the right direction or the wrong direction? And here it goes. So God in his grace confuses their language, frustrates their ideas, and yet sin spreads out still, again, all over the globe. And in the midst of all that, in chapter 12, we see God go from the universal to the particular. His heart is always chasing after his original intent. And he's always looking for a body to carry that out. And he chooses a man, Avram, from the city of Ur in Mesopotamia, very near the biblical identification of the Tigris and Euphrates River in the Fertile Crescent right there in Ur, which is, again, modern-day Iraq. He calls out a man. He speaks to a man who lives in a polytheistic culture surrounded by thousands of gods, and he speaks and he reveals to him himself as the one God. And he says to him, listen to me, go to a land I will show you. Trust me, listen to me, because through you, all people on earth will be blessed. Now, his name is Avram, which means exalted father. And that's a weird thing, because he's fatherless, the tension of the story tells us. He has no kids. His wife, Sarai, is barren. And yet, it says he believes God. He trusts him. He relies upon him. He obeys him. And based upon that, God credits this to him as right standing, as righteousness. And he takes off on this journey. And he heads off with this promise that he's going to have a kid someday. And he goes to the land of Canaan in the story. And there he settles down, and immediately a threat comes in the form of a famine. And that threat of the famine causes him to lose faith for a moment in his God. And he travels to Egypt, to the Nile God. The Nile was a god. It was water, the god of water. And he went there. And in there, this rescue mission is threatened. Because there, he's in fear and insecurity. He passes off his wife as a sister, and she ends up in the harem of Pharaoh. And right now, you're like, this, you know, I thought he's supposed to have kids. If he's supposed to have kids with Sarah, this whole thing's going downhill right now because she's in the wrong place at the wrong time. And then God comes in and rescues him. And we see a strong and powerful image that's going to continue throughout, an exodus of sorts. He rescues Abraham by the grace of God alone. He rescues Sarah, and he takes them out of Egypt. and back into the promised land, and they come into the promised land with more than what they went into. They leave Egypt with more than they went into. God blesses them. A great message for us. God blesses us, even when we screw it up at times, because God is good. It's his nature of blessing. So he begins to establish himself and his family there, and we see that. He has his nephew with him a lot, and we see what takes place in the issue of Lot's decisions and choices. Lot continues to go east, which is the wrong way. Lot gets into trouble. He's rescued by Abram. Abram is now reconfirmed with God that he is going to be God's chosen vessel through which all people on earth are going to be blessed. The statement of his blessing of his son comes back again. He will have a son, but years are going by. And his wife decides to take matters into her own hands, as we sometimes do, trying to help God out. And takes a woman by the name of Hagar, who was one of the one of the baggage or blessing, however you want to call it. This poor woman who's treated less than human is comes along as a slave, and all of a sudden she becomes a handmaiden to Abram, and he is given a son through him, but not the son that will be the conduit through which the ultimate rescue comes. This son's name is Ishmael, and you know that story. Ishmael's a son, but it's not the son. Ishmael's where the Arabic people find their roots. As a matter of fact, about 2,500 years later, when Islam comes on the scene, Islam in the 7th century takes that story and changes the direction of it, making Ishmael the son of promise rather than Isaac. Some editing that takes place a long time afterwards, but they're leaning. Their prejudice towards the scripture takes Ishmael as the promised son in the 7th century. But we know he's not the promised son, and we see Hagar hatred and anger and pain, Sarai mistreating her, all these family dysfunctions. But God blesses Ishmael and promises Hagar that he too will be a great nation. And then God gives Abraham the covenant of circumcision. Huge. It's a mark in the flesh, a carving in the flesh of his promises to Abram, who is renamed Abraham. He is going to be a father of many. And as that happens, we get this strong imagery of his progeny. The son's going to come, but it takes 25 years before his son comes, Isaac, Yitzhak, Isaac. He laughs. Isaac comes on the scene 25 years later. Sometimes the promises of God take a long time. Maybe you've experienced that in your life. And sometimes we stress. Sometimes we lose faith. Abraham did. Sometimes we fail. Sometimes we try to take matters into our own hands. We do those things. God understands those things. So now Isaac is on the scene. And we've been waiting and waiting for Isaac to come. And then all of a sudden, Isaac is on the scene. He's a young boy, and we have the Akedah, the binding of Isaac. All of a sudden, this favored son, the son through which the whole world is going to be saved, all of a sudden, God says, take him up to a mountain called Moriah and offer him as a holocaust offering, a fully consumed offering to me. And we get that really strange story. And we went deeply into the emotions of that. What was that like for Abraham? What was that like for Isaac? And they go to Moriah. And the tradition holds it that Mount Moriah is the same Mount Moriah today where the temple stands in Jerusalem today. That Mount Moriah today is where Christian tradition holds that Jesus was, in fact, taken to on his uphill journey to Calvary. And on Moriah, Isaac carries the wood. And for Christians, that's a strong metaphor, as Jesus carried the wood. And he builds an altar, and his father binds him and lays him on the altar. The interesting thing is, if you remember, before he went up the mountain, he had two servants. And this is a really powerful image, and many of the midrashes catch this. And we as Christians see this as well. He says to his servants, stay here. The boy and I are going up the mountain, and the boy and I will return. that's rad. See, because Abram's been given a promise, and God is a promise keeper, not a promise breaker. And his faith has evolved to that point now. His faith has evolved in God to the point that he says, okay, I'm going to put my son up there, and I'm going to butcher him for God. But somehow, some way, God's going to have to resurrect him to life because he made a promise. And he said, through him, my seed would continue and would be as countless as the stars in the sky. So I don't know what he's going to do. I don't know how he's going to do it, but somehow he's going to resurrect the dead. The boy and I are coming up. The boy and I are coming down. And God calls him off. He's, remember, knife in hand, and offers him a substitution. Now, as I told you before, when Abraham was asked to kill his son, that was no big deal for Abraham, in one sense. The Mesopotamian culture, the religions of the day, human sacrifice, child sacrifice, was ongoing. As I said, people lived in fear of the gods. The gods were angry, and what do we got to do to appease the gods? And this continued in an escalation and an evolution of sacrificial systems that culminated with human sacrifice. And the younger, the better. Infants were sacrificed in many of those cultures on a ritual basis. Firstborns were sacrificed. Why? Because the firstborn, in the firstborn, is wrapped up all the continuation of the line and the hope. And yet God calls him off, and we see a substitutionary sacrifice, a ram. And a couple of things we learn. First of all, a very high level of sophistication that the Torah brings us is that no human sacrifice is accepted by God. Right? And we see this very compassionate system of the substitutionary sacrifice of animals. And even that, in Judaism, is a very, how can I say it? It's a very humane thing. To have an animal that's kosher means that the animal was slaughtered in such a fashion that it was as humane as possible. But you also have to understand this, even in the rabbinical literature today, that's not what God intended. When a Jew eats meat, an observant one, he's always cognizant of the fact that it's a symbol of death, of the fact that the world is not the way it's supposed to be. It becomes actually a ritual. It's an allowance that God gives through certain procedures, kosher procedures, but when you eat the meat, you eat that meat soberly, realizing the world is screwed up. It's full of death. It becomes a holy ritual. I don't know how many of us actually do that when we go to McDonald's, but it becomes an awareness when we eat meat. The world is not the way it's supposed to be. It screams that out. And God is looking to bring a rescue, a restoration, a healing. Ultimately, we believe that restoration is found in Jesus. And we ask some interesting questions. Because a couple of thousand years later, another son is going to climb that hill at Moriah. And this time, the hand of God doesn't pull off. This time, a human sacrifice is made in some mysterious and mind-boggling way that we can't even begin to wrap our head around. Some way, this substitutionary sacrifice becomes the one and only one acceptable to God that is human. And in some strange way, his death, Jesus' death, becomes that ultimate zenith of God's rescue mission for the world, in so much that the sins of the world can be forgiven. A substitution has been made. A perfect lamb has been slaughtered. In some mysterious way, in Jesus' death, he becomes, as Paul writes, the absorber of everything polluted. He who had no sin became sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. Paul writes in Colossians 1 that the restoration of everything begins with Jesus. And everything means everything. It just doesn't mean me. It just doesn't mean, you know, I get my, you know, e-ticket and fire insurance to heaven. It means everything in the creative order, in the entire cosmos, is now going to be restored through what he did. And through what we adhere to as followers of him. Well, he comes down the mountain. I'm sure that was kind of a weird scene. I still wonder what Isaac was thinking. I still do. Like, that's really cool, Dad. Thanks for not killing me. Okay, but so he comes down off the mountain, and we come to the death of Sarah. So chapter 22 ends, and chapter 23 begins, and we might take a quick look at this. Yes, we got time. And if we go to chapter 23 of Genesis, Sarah dies. Sarah's 127 years old. She dies at Kiriath Arba. This is Hebron in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went to mourn for Sarah and to weep over her. You have to understand, when somebody died back then, you didn't have mortuaries. You didn't have, I mean, it was like an immediate process, because especially the climate and the weather, things had to be done. So he's in immediate mourning and with the body. And then verse 3 says, of chapter 23, then Abraham rose from beside his dead wife and spoke to the Hittites. Hittites are not the Indo-European culture, but Hittites are a derivative of the Canaanites that are there. And he said, I am an alien, a resident alien is a better translation, and a stranger amongst you. Sell me some property for a burial site here so I can bury my dead. And the Hittites, you know, go on to say, hey, listen, you're a mighty prince. You can take any tomb you want. It's no big deal. Use what you want. And then Abraham, verse 7 says, rose and bowed down before the people of the land, the Hittites. Now, you've got to understand, this is like a town hall meeting. Abraham is what? He's a foreigner. He's an alien in the land of Canaan. But it's the land that God promised to him, and he told him to stay there, and he's getting the message now. And he's staying there. He's trusting God that somehow, some way, through his seed, God is going to give him this land. And through his seed, all people on earth are going to be blessed. And he says, this is really interesting. He says, he bowed down to the people of the land. And he said to them, if you're willing to let me bury my dead, then listen to me and intercede with Ephron, son of Zohar, on my behalf. He will send me, he will sell me the cave at Machpelah, which belongs to him and is at the end of his field. Ask him to sell it to me for the full price as a burial site amongst you. It's very interesting. He wants to purchase some property. And it says, Ephron the Hittite was sitting amongst the people, and he replied to Abraham in the hearing of all the Hittites that had come to the city gate. No, my lord, he says, listen to me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that's in it. I give it to you in the presence of my people. Bury your dead. This is a very typical conversation. It's really, really lovely, as you can trace even modern-day conversations to this ancient language and to the ancient traditions. This has become a classic Middle East bargaining situation. This has everything to do with etiquette. Boy, I really like that vase. How much is that vase? No. You take it. It's free. No, I can't take it. How much is it? Well, if I must, it's $400. Really? $400? I'll give you $100. No, $300. Well, the best I can do is $200. $200 sold. That, this is just a typical way of transacting here. And you see it so beautifully here in the ancient situation here. It says, again, Abraham bowed down before the people of the land, and he said to Ephron in their hearing, listen to me. If you will, I will pay the price of the field. Accept it from me so I can bury my dead here. And Ephron answered Abraham, listen to me, my lord. The land is worth 400 shekels of silver. But what is that between you and me? Bury your dead. So this is negotiated. Now, 400 is an exorbitant amount of money. It's about 10 pounds of silver. And we know exactly what the trade exchanges were, because we've unearthed so many of these documents and cuneiforms that go back to Mesopotamia, which is one of the wonderful things about archaeological and biblical research, is you can find extant evidences to what's taking place here and giving it authority and authenticity. So it's a fat number of dollars. And then he says, this is where it gets weird. Verse 16 says, Abraham agreed to Ephron's terms and weighed out for him the price he had named in the hearing of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver, according to the weight current amongst the merchants. That's interesting. He doesn't haggle. Now, I'm going to say something to you, just as a point of note. Have you taken care of your burial arrangements yet? Because if you haven't, it's something you might want to think about. Because I've been doing, you know, I've been burying people for 12 years. And why I say that is because, listen, if it's no big deal to you, that's great. And if the family understands it's no big deal, that's great. But sometimes a lot of funky stuff enters the picture. Sometimes somebody dies unexpectedly, there's a lot of unsaid and undid things. And then suddenly, a lot of people in their grieving state can really go over the top, or they can be exploited, or they can try to make up for it, and they spend tens of thousands of dollars to try to build a monument to the person they treated like crap their whole life. You know, that's like, oh yeah, I'm really sorry. You know, I'm going to do that. I'm going to make up for it to you now that you're dead. You know, or, you know, it's really weird. Then, you know, family members start fighting. It's really pretty good for you to think ahead and let people know what you want. What's the big deal? You know? And some people do that. I mean, there's nothing wrong. I mean, Abraham, I think here, Abraham doesn't haggle because, first of all, he's pretty rich. And second of all, it's not about that. He wants to give a proper burial to his wife. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that instinct to say, I want to do the best for my loved one. If everybody's on the same page. Kathy pretty much knows. You can bury me in the backyard in a shoebox. I don't care. I'm fine with it. I'm not, no big deal. I don't. You know, I'm not into that. So don't build any monuments to me. Just don't use the money to go to the Bahamas. That's all I'm saying. No, actually, go ahead and use the money. Go to the Bahamas. I think that's great. So just something about arrangements. So Ephron, he gives him the field, and he buys. But this is the interesting thing in verse 18. And let me just read from verse 17. Sorry, Anne. So Ephron's field in Machpelah near Mamre is both the field and the cave in it, and all the trees within the borders of the field were deeded to Abraham as his property in the presence of all the Hittites who had come to the city gates. Afterwards, Abraham buried his wife in the cave at Hebron. Verse 20 says, the field and the cave in it were deeded. This is really, the field and the cave were deeded. This is the first actual ownership of property in Canaan. It's a drop of the promise. It's a little patch of ground, but it becomes a drop of the promise that will come. Now, I want to talk about property and everything else. We're going to look at that. One of the things that I want to close with here is I want to touch on the subject of anger, because one of the things that we see in this story up to here, we see the breakdown of humanity, and we see a lot of blood and violence. We see a lot of anger. And I want to just give just a quick teaching on anger. I want to ask you, what causes anger? If you look in the biblical narrative in the story, you see all kinds of things. You see hurt, physical, emotional pain. You see frustration. Frustration meaning like things aren't going the way I thought they would or should go. You see insecurity. Cain and Abel, you know? Cain is an insecure dude. He's very insecure, and that bleeds out into anger. You know the story's going to go bad when one's a shepherd and one's a tiller of the soil. In the ancient culture, you heard that story, you already know, ooh, this is trouble. You got a shepherd, no boundaries. You got a landowner, boundaries. Sheeps and flocks and field owners, bam. That's trouble, ready to go. And blood is spilt on the ground because of anger and frustration, perhaps about the land. It's still happening over there today. Look at all the nutty stuff that is going on today. About the land. So what is it that causes anger? Now, on average, men lose their temper twice as much as women. It's not because women are better. It's just that we have something called testosterone, okay? It causes problems for us. We're slightly brain damaged. You need to know that, okay? Just take that into consideration. That's not to say that a woman can't get mad, because a woman tends to be more... Men tend to be, because of their testosterone, boilers. In other words, because of testosterone, a lot of time we're hot anyways. And then issues come, and then it doesn't take many degrees of increase to all of a sudden, boom, spill over. Women tend to bottle. Men can do this too. But women tend to be, in their nature, they stuff it. Oh, you did that to me. Okay, I'm not saying anything. I'm not saying anything. And this goes on sometimes for years until they lose their temper. And then it's like, you know, and then it's just like spewed out. And that's a dangerous thing. At least it is with Kathy. I don't know about you. She rarely gets mad. But when she does, the kids are like out the window, flying through the, you know, we're out the doors. Everybody's running out of the way. It's not good. We know we've messed up. So, the interesting thing about anger is that anger is most expressed, guess where? In the home to those closest to us. statistically, most violent crimes take place in the home. It takes us right back to that first murder, a brother and a brother. Family, domestic violence, and anger and dysfunction. It's right there. Now, the issue I want to say about anger is that everybody gets angry, and that does not mean it's sinful. And can you put up Ephesians 4, 26 and 7? I would say to you that there is a right time to get angry about the right stuff and the right amount of anger in the right way. Few of us get it right. But anger in of itself is not... God gets angry when he sees the injustices in the world. He gets angry when he sees greed and exploitation. He gets angry when he sees the environment, his creation, exploited and destroyed. When he sees people, his creation, exploited and destroyed. This makes God angry. There are things worth getting angry about. But we have to get angry at the right time and the right way with the right amount, and few of us do that. See, the thing about God's anger, he has a holy equilibrium. His anger is always in equilibrium with his other attributes, with his mercy, with his grace, with his compassion, with his patience. Few of us can get that equilibrium, right? God has an equilibrium with his anger, but we can at least shoot for it. If we go back to the Genesis story in chapter 4, and we don't need to look at that, you can see this. Do not let the sun go down while you are still angry. Do not give the devil a foothold. That's a great one. Just, you know what I mean? Sometimes we need to settle the issues before it's too late. Sometimes time isn't our... We need to say sorry closer. I mean, to the infraction. We need to do that. In the case of Cain and Abel, if you remember that story, God goes to Cain and asks him, why are you angry? Good question. If you're ever really upset, ask yourself why, and then really sit down and try to analyze it. And don't go with the first answer that comes out. Spend time to reflect. Go vertically. Pray to God. Ask for help. Look to Jesus. Because a lot of times when we really spend time and we start to think about it, what we're angry about isn't really the issue. It's other issues. Or it's an accumulation of issues. And we have to begin to seek counsel and go to God and find out, why is this happening to me? To take a time out. Reflect before we react. To go vertical to God. In our anger, there's nothing wrong with seeking justice. But we don't want to sin. We don't want to sin in seeking justice. We don't want to seek vengeance. We don't want... That's really... God says, let me handle that thing. To seek justice is right. Justice is an attribute of God's character. We want justice. We just don't want to do it in our own hands. I remember when I was a little kid, there was a bully on the street, and this bully beat me up. And I came home. He was older than me, you know? And I came home, and he was a trouble kid. And I got home, my dad says, okay, here. Opens a closet, and he pulls out like this stick, like an old broken leg from a chair. He says, go take this, go back there, and give it to him. And I'm like, really? Awesome. I run out the front door. I am angry. I'm crying. I'm crying angry. You know that rage that comes in crying? But now I got an equalizer. And that kid sees me coming at him, and I'm telling you, he begins to haul buns, and he runs. And I chase, and he's a bigger kid, and he ran away. I felt so satisfied, you know? It felt good. But was it the right thing to do? No, it wasn't. Was it the right impulse to want it? Absolutely. To want to get some justice for what happened to me? Absolutely. Now, that's not what I'm teaching my son. And I'm not saying my dad is some kind of evil person. It's just a messed up way because, you know what, I deal with families all the time. And guess what? You go over and you beat that kid. Guess what happens next? Retaliation. They come back and they beat you up. And guess what happens next? Then we go back and we firebomb their house. Guess what? Then they come back and they do a drive-by shooting at yours. And this thing just escalates out of control. It happens all the time. I encourage us to go to Jesus. I love this verse. And can you go to Romans chapter 12, verse 17? We have to somewhere trust that God's justice is going to prevail. We can seek it in the courts. And we can, you know, I understand that. Hey, a woman comes to me and says, my husband cheated on me. I'm going to cheat on him. No. Don't. That's not the solution, right? Now, separation and divorce might be. But retaliation, That's not going to bring you anything that you want. Romans 12 said, do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everybody. Next verse. Paul writes, if it's possible, as far as depends on you, live in shalom with everyone. Next verse, 19. Do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, it is mine to avenge. I will repay, says the Lord. Verse 20. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him, thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. That does not mean you're going to burn his head off with a bucket. That actually means to sear the conscience. It means to do good to your enemy may cause them to reflect deeply about the harm they've done to you, and it may change their heart and spirit. That they may go, ah, man, I messed up. Next verse. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. It's like one of the few moments that Paul actually sounds like Jesus, which is unfortunately rare, but he gets it once in a while. In suffering injustice, do not sin. Trust God's justice. That doesn't mean you don't seek justice. You can. We need to, but that doesn't mean you always get it. You know how many people around the globe right now are suffering injustice and can't get it? Of course, we can't leave it at that. It becomes incumbent upon us as extensions, as followers of the God who made the heavens and the earth, of the one who wants to bring restoration and equilibrium to the whole world through Jesus Christ, to be his ambassadors and to seek justice, to intercede, and to be ambassadors of reconciliation. Anger. The impulse, I want to close with this thought. The impulse to seek revenge is not evil. In of itself, it is in fact a reflection of God in us. But his image in us, and we as his image bearers, is corrupted. It's corrupted by our broken nature. So I can trust vengeance into God's hands, but not my own. I just have to give it to God. I really do. And so much as it depends upon me, I got to be what Jesus calls me, be a peacemaker, to bring shalom. When he was on the cross, he did not retaliate, but he entrusted himself to God. You can handle it. He took the evil, sought to overcome it with good. That's something we can learn from these powerful, powerful, powerful lives in this book of Genesis. And we're going to see it. We're going to see it ahead of us. And we're going to see it most particularly in a man named Joseph. We're going to get to that soon. And it's going to be a really great journey as we see how to handle real-life conflicts. Okay, that's it for now. Next week, I want you to look ahead because we're going to look at Isaac and Rebecca, and I'm going to give you the secret formula to finding the most perfect mate. Yeah, all you got to do is come next week if you're single, and I'm going to give you the formula to find the perfect person for you. Trust me. It's going to involve some camels. It's going to involve some goats. No, it's going to be all right. So that's what we're going to do next week. All right, now we're caught up, and we're ready to go into the second half of Genesis, which I promise you will flow a lot quicker than the first half. But it's going to be really, really good stuff. And we're going to see Jesus dripping through the pages, and it's going to be really cool.